This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
So we've turned the corner on the sort of long-form genealogy. I feel like it was... I feel like I want to, like, immediately apologize for it, though, because it was... I mean, there's just so many gaps. There's just so many gaps, and every century, every year, everything, you know, four or five different people or four or five different things to read pop in that I didn't say, this, that, and the other. And then on the other hand, just the looseness with which the things I did talk about, it, maybe I made things worse, right? Like, the point, though, is that there are great resources out there on the specifics, and there are great scholars out there on the specifics, people who are devoted to just one of any one of these things. And so I would say, you know, seek out people who are able to do more justice to the depth of the themes. And really all I'm doing here is trying to really establish almost like an argument through genealogy, through the breadth of the tradition. But if you have, I mean, I think by now you clearly notice that there's a an agenda of sorts and a narrative of sorts that I'm weaving in, you know. And I hopefully I haven't been coy or passive aggressive about that. It's a very clear view. I'm going to keep honing away at that. Yeah?
What is the agenda exactly?
The agenda is a sort of a secular rendition of the Universal Church.
Okay,
fair enough. So for me, if we have an exclusively a super sacred rendition of our relations, in my mind, just to put it in very simple terms, that's not a family. So if your understanding of your own family is like untouchable, pure, clean, you know, not that. And by the way, to secularize it in the way I'm speaking doesn't mean that you're disrespectful, and I hope I haven't crossed any of those lines. But it does mean that you have wit, that you have a sense of humor, you have a sense of tragedy, you have a sense of drama, you have a sense of appreciating the genealogy itself as something of a work of art, even, you could say. So for me, the overly sacred rendition of that genealogy, while it may be inspirational in some ways, I don't know for how long it can last under those terms. I'm also sensitive to the fact that the modern church, as we're going to move into today, has unique challenges and has had some very unique contemporary failures. And as a cradle Catholic, as a Roman Catholic, as a person who, like I said... The church is my only home. I have no plans on leaving. I have no plans on going anywhere. But I have no plans on turning averting my eyes to things either. I mean, to me, this is a... So to secularize the tradition and to render the Catholic intellectual tradition in relation not only to Greece, Athens, Rome, but also, as you saw yesterday, to modern philosophy in a fruitful and, I would say, constructive way. You know, there are people who disagree with me, right? Who are some of those people? Well, people who say that the Catholic intellectual tradition basically starts with St. Paul and certainly has some Hellenic influences, but kind of grows on its own two feet, certainly, you know, rises up majorly with Augustine and then hits its climax with Aquinas, and it's all downhill from there, right? Believe it or not, this is a very, very popular and very, very common reading of the intellectual tradition, not only by Thomists. In fact, I'd say many Thomists who are serious wouldn't buy that because they'd see Thomism as a tradition that's been working on itself for many years. But there is a sort of a view that sort of, you know, the church peaked intellectually with Aquinas and the Middle Ages, and ever since then it's just been one challenge after another, and kind of, you know, this desire for this kind of false nostalgia, right?
The golden age sort of thing, right?
Yeah,
you know, the passive.
And certainly I would say there have been quite a few golden ages, including the golden age, which was partly golden because there was tons of gold being stolen from the coffers of the Aztec Empire. And so, you know, yeah, it was a definite boost in the economy. And it produced Cervantes, who I adore. So, like, don't... Again, I don't want to present, hopefully, a balanced view, but I also don't want to present a view that's so unbalanced that it's not able to appreciate what I think should be appreciated and also feel a bit chastened by those things that it should be chastened by. Mm-hmm. But that's, I guess, my agenda. When people hear Catholic intellectual tradition, I think they might have some assumptions about what that is that would be, on the Catholic end, pious to a point of blindness, you could say, of mm-hmm. Just the frankness of the past and of the historicity of everything that this stuff happens mm-hmm. in social relations and in cultural contexts and in political empires and what have you. But on the other hand, that the intellectual side of the tradition is just all about just books and not about ideas and feelings and realities and stuff that really... I mean, to me, this is about real stuff. It's not just, you know... All the way back to the Iliad, I believe that question of immortality is like not just it's myth in the sense I mentioned it on the first lecture, which was myth as in having more truth to tell us, not as being something that's not true. So because it's fiction, it has the ability to communicate truth at a much deeper level to us than the nonfiction. So my joke is that my favorite nonfiction, so Frederick nonfiction book. It is poetry for genre, and my favorite fiction is autobiography.
Yeah.
Right? So these are my two, you know, favorite genres of literature. Right? At any rate, so that's my agenda. I hope it's clear. I hope it's consistent with what I've actually said. I hope it's not too crazy just to argue. It also, though, has something of a practical. Point in that, hey, guess what? You don't have to be scared of everything around you, from the books to the press to the media to so and so, you know, from Friedrich Nietzsche or whoever. Like, you know, I mean, I went and saw God Is Dead, the film. Right? I went and saw it. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and by the way, I tried so hard. Like, oh, those Protestants, God bless them.
It was a weird film.
Yeah. But guess what? The screenwriters were Catholic.
Were they really?
Yeah, they were. Yeah, they were. So, you know, seeing a piece of media like that, that reaches a sort of kind of popularity in our day, was one of many different experiences that I've had that led me to believe that we need to be able to talk about our intellectual, cultural, religious inheritance, but in a way that avoids the dangers of making a spectacle out of ourselves, right? You know, and so, you know, I also grew up, by the way, in a very sheltered Catholic, I call it the Catholic ghetto, right? I grew up in the Charismatic Renewal in the English version through the kind of covenant communities of the United States, and in the Spanish version in the Renovación Cristiana of Mexico and Latin America. And I have so much appreciation for that charism and for that spirituality. I'm a musician because of it. You know, I have so much that I owe it. But there was this constant state of paranoia that I feel used to just be us, and then all of a sudden kind of infected everyone. Like, I was like, why is everyone thinking it's cool to be paranoid like we were in the 80s, you know, all of a sudden. And so I see this, and I read, you know, I'm the editor of Pathos Catholic, so I'm pretty aware of what the digital tone is like, you know, these days, and has been for a while and stuff. And so, you know, so hopefully the secularized idea of the Catholic intellectual tradition isn't unwarranted or isn't an overreaction, but if you want to know the why to the what, that's the why. You know, it's to try and give. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean, though, that the people who are doing the other kinds of works, whether it's Christopher Dawson or whether it's, you know, Father Robert Barron or whether it's, you know, Jeff Cavins or whether it's Scott Hahn's approach or whether it's, you know, the EWTN pastiche or whether it's whoever it is, you know, the. Well, there are a few actually that I do have like really strong objections to. Matthew Kelly, don't get me started. But for the most part, I think you know, sure, them too, of course. I think that the audience for the Ascension Press, Ignatius Press, EWTN, Catholic Radio, I would leave Salt and Light out of it. I think they're a very different. I think their approach is quite different, in fact, and I'm deeply, deeply, deeply grateful for the even just the aesthetics of their media is just very different and very interesting to me. And it's not what I know, so I don't want to judge it in advance, but I just don't want to lump it in with the others. I just believe, though, that the audience for that is a very particular one, and it's one that certainly has been edified and certainly has been, in some sense, evangelized through it. But I'm not so sure if that diet is a lasting diet. And if you sort of, well, how do you know? Well, I eat that diet for a long time, and I run. I found myself, a bit underfed at a certain point. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about a critique of the liberal side of popular Catholic media? I'm not to say that.
Sure. I mean, I have no really use for the sentimentalism of Richard Rohr, to be completely honest. I don't. So you got to realize I wasn't raised on a Commonweal America diet. I was raised on the other one. On the prototypes of that one. Yeah. So that's what I know.
So, you know.
So I can only critique what I know. Now, I have to say, though, there is a certain kind of, upper middle class to, cool Brooklyn, New York feel to the social justice warriors of Commonweal in America and that kind of crowd. That's extremely off-putting to me for a number of reasons. So, I don't naturally find myself, because of these affections and disaffections, sipping coffee with, Thomas Merton is the greatest thing in the world club, either. And in many cases, though, my objections to the small exposure I've had to that side is actually identical, just a mirror image of the other side, I guess you could say. I have had a lot of interesting conversations with friends of mine who are pretty much liturgically traditionalists.
Yeah.
And I want to make a very hard distinction between a liturgical traditionalist and the sort of traditionalist that moves out of liturgy into a critique of the church whole cloth, right? I mean, hopefully it's not controversial to say that I'm opposed to the sort of radical traditionalism that wants to say that Francis is, the Antichrist and this, that, and the other thing.
Thank you. Yes.
But at the same time, I think there are a lot of people who are liturgically inclined in a very sort of classical model, and many of them fans of Benedict, that while I think that the descriptive liturgical norms that they're advocating for are a little bit stringent, but I think the principles they advocate for them for with are applicable. Mm-hmm. And I think for them it's just like, okay, so how are you going to do a Latin Adorietum, Mass in the village in Honduras?
Yeah.
So would you argue that there's room for both the sides in our church then?
To me, it's not even a question of both, it's all, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So I think there's it is universal in this case. And so I can recognize the universalism of a traditionalist liturgical argument very easily. And I can't recognize it, frankly, though, in the paranoid sort of idea that Francis is some sort of...
To destroy the good traditions.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of, thing. So,
good.
But yeah. But obviously, though, if I was raised, I hope, on a different diet, and if that diet ran out, you would expect that I would be, probably pressing against another side. But you can only critique what you know. Right. And that's, for me, what's important. The things you should grow to, in some sense, inhabit, but you should also grow to understand their deepest flaws and limits. And let's start with ourselves, right? To be oneself and to, in Socrates' terms, know oneself, begins with not the ability to be like, gosh, I'm a nice guy, aren't I? Or, gosh, I'm pretty great, or I'm really good at this or that. That's, in some sense, to be deeply unself-aware, isn't it? But to know oneself is to know that when the head hits the pillow, there's this fear, and there's this insecurity, and there's this struggle, and that the conscience is toils over this, that, and the other. That's what it is, I think, to know oneself in a full and rich and deep kind of a way. And so in a similar case, to know the church, I think, is not just to be able to celebrate the church as a sort of naive self. I think it's to know the church in the same, at the same level of existential depth as we would take seriously knowing ourselves, you know. So, and I think the moving into the three popes, I think the last three popes we have actually have done this both in very, very different ways, but with an enormous amount of depth. And I think they might help us to think about these things called the transcendentals.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
The name of the program is Manage Your Money God's Way. And at Compass Catholic Ministry, we use the Bible as a guide to financial freedom, becoming debt-free. With over 2,500 verses in the Bible dealing with money, you'll hear the importance God has placed on managing that gift He's provided you. That's Manage Your Money God's Way from Compass Catholic Ministry, Saturday mornings at 9 Eastern and Sundays at 5 Eastern on BreadboxMedia.com.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And I think the moving into the three popes, I think the last three popes we have actually have done this both in very, very different ways, but with an enormous amount of depth. And I think they might help us to think about these things called the transcendentals. Real quick, what is a transcendental? What does the word transcendental mean? The meaning I take for transcendence is a very literal meaning, which is to say that transcendence is something that has the capacity to pierce through. So to transcend is to be able to pierce through something. So to be beyond something in the transcendental sense doesn't mean that, first of all, that you don't come into contact with it, but it means that you can arrive at it and keep on moving through, right? Mm-hmm. So transcendence, my claim, is more Aristotelian in that it has the ability to come into contact with the concrete, but to keep moving through the concrete. Whereas the externalized idea of transcendence is that it sort of just like floats away from it. So there's an idea of transcendence that is sort of works through things on the one hand, and on the other hand, an idea of transcendence that just floats beyond it like that. I'm very much in favor and will hopefully rely on an idea of the going through. Why going through instead of floating beyond? Well, My view of this is that the transcendentals are not things that are, strictly speaking, ethereal entities that just halo over things, but that the transcendentals are embedded in the very structure of reality, that we can find them in all things in a very intimate way, but that when we encounter them, they keep pushing us to keep moving, right, and keep moving through the things. So materialism that I was critical of yesterday isn't a bad start. Like, I have nothing against matter, right? The problem, though, is it's a bad stop, right? So we can be materialists, and with a little bit of transcendence, we'll get through, and then we'll stop. So the problem with materialism is its lack of transcendence, not its dependence on matter. You would be, I think, crazy in this day and age to not think that matter is really important. But at the same time, I think you'd be crazy to stop everything once you reach matter, right? And so, to me, these are points of emphasis. And so transcendence, the transcendentals are things that have a capacity to not only encounter the world or encounter things as they are, but to also pierce through them with a certain kind of an insight. Yeah.
Well, you cannot avoid that, you know, being materialistic. you know, at a certain moment.
Yeah.
You know, at a certain time.
Sure.
I mean, they call that I think, therefore I am. And it means that, you know, something like existentialism, right? And but if he doesn't exist, how could he think?
Yeah.
Okay? He has to be in existing, which is the precondition. Therefore, he can think. But if you remove that condition, and you just, how are you going to...
Exactly, yeah. We need some sort of place that can springboard us, you could say. And so for me, one of the reasons for this secularized idea of the tradition is that in many cases, the springboard for numerous saints, I mean, and people in our tradition we look up to, was not going to Mass, or was not prayer, but was an encounter with the secular world itself that springboarded them into a sense of transcendence and an appetite for transcendence that eventually led them to arrive at a spiritual place that we would call inhabiting the Catholic, you know, worldview. So the idea of the transcendentals, and this is another reason for my emphasis, is that beauty, truth, and goodness, or in the order I'm going to go, goodness, truth, and beauty, they don't belong to us, the Catholics. And the way that this set of relations, especially at its most Catholic points, in some ways does. I mean, hey, I don't think anyone can get away with saying that Augustine doesn't have a certain intimate relationship to the Roman Catholic Church. Like, no one's going to, I think, get away with that one. You know, Aquinas isn't going to ever stray too far from things. Now, neither are they going to be able to stray completely away from the Greeks, but when we get now from genealogy to just ideas, goodness is not good because it's Catholic, because it's actually not proper in and of itself to Catholicism. However, Catholicism recognizes the transcendence of goodness and recognizes goodness itself as a transcendental concept that we can use in many different forms, but among those forms we can use to enrich and to add depth and breadth to our own sense of Catholicity, to our own sense of faith. But there's no one in the world, I don't think, I don't think there is such a thing as apologetics about goodness. Like, not in the sort of argument sense. Like, I think there's a sort of intuitive buying, like, goodness, if we understand the word the same, which in many cases we don't, but if we can understand goodness, like, do you want, let's go have lunch, good. Would you rather have good food, or would you like to have bad food? Well, maybe the person is very clever and they said, well, I've really been craving some bad food lately, right? Well, that's very interesting. Tell me more about that, right? That's fascinating. But there's a general sense that people of goodwill and of good faith I'm even using the word, who are willing to have a sort of, you could say, honest human interaction, are always going to say, well, let's have good food if it's available. Like, let's try to be good here, right? So this idea of goodness, while it's very simple and very human and very broad and very basic, it also, though, points us towards its antithesis. So what is the antithesis of the good? What is the thing that is the opposite of goodness? Well, we could say badness, bad. That's the antonym, semantically speaking. But there's something about bad that isn't quite bad enough, right? Bad doesn't quite seem to get at what really opposes the good. Here we encounter, again, the question of evil. So to me, goodness is so broad and so general, and it's a word that we throw around so much in such a way, that it might be more helpful to actually think about evil as a way to understand the transcendence of goodness. So I'm sort of reverse engineering the idea of goodness with the concept, and not just the concept, but the presence and reality of evil. What are the most concrete places that I could think of where we might think of evil? I don't want to go to the question of evil and the metaphysics, because we've already kind of done that with Augustine. And to be honest, sharks and parasites don't move me to understand evil and the way that something like the problem of suffering does. Right? I've had many people in very, very good faith say, you know, Sam, I know you believe in God and you know, you're a Catholic and stuff. And I was raised Catholic too. But whenever I see the suffering in this world, I lose all my imagination for all this God stuff. There's just no way that these two things could exist. And the presence of suffering is so real to me that it just abolishes the possibility of some good, loving, you know, God out there, this, that, and the other. Let me just say that there is nothing to be scoffed at from that claim if it's made with a sense of seriousness, with a sense of honesty, with a sense of reality. Don't forget that grace is operating through all of this. So if not by the grace of God, I could see, you know, anyone coming up with that answer and with no fault at all. You know, it makes sense. And I believe that the Catholic intellectual tradition, while it gives us a lot of really beautiful and elegant responses, theoretical, philosophical, metaphysical responses to the question of the problem of evil, I don't know if we've had as robust a teaching on the problem of evil through the phenomena of suffering as we've had from John Paul II. So the key text to consult in this case would be his text Salvifici Doloris, which means the salvation of suffering. Oh yeah, sure. Let's put it in here.
This wasn't an encyclical, it was just a document?
No, I don't know if it was promulgated. I think it's an encyclical. I think it is. Yeah, it is. It's really short, unlike most of John Paul II's encyclicals. I think it's just an absolutely gorgeous encyclical. And I don't think this encyclical... I think without this encyclical, reading, for instance, the Gospel of Life, just it makes no sense without reading this encyclical. The Gospel of Life is controversial in some Catholic right-left conversations because he gives a very expansive view of life, which goes from the personal and the biomedical all the way to the social and things like that. And so you could say that the Gospel of Life is one of the documents that the whole cloth argument of the, the whole cloth pro-life argument builds out of. I find that argument, though, between Catholics is rather inconsequential without taking really seriously the question of suffering that he raises. Here. I think it's just an essential text for understanding that. But if we can go into John Paul II's biography, I think we might understand a little bit more closely why the presence of suffering is so important. Obviously, John Paul II is a Pole. He's Polish. And he grew up in Central Europe during a period of time in which it's hard to argue that, at least within the modern era, Poland suffered arguably more as a nation and as a people in both directions throughout the great wars of Europe at that time. They were occupied, of course, in the Second World War by Germany, and once Germany was driven out by Russia and the Allied forces, then the Soviet Union set in. And that was the sort of the reward for their... Now, John Paul II was also lost his father, I believe, at a very early age. He was not a person of any means whatsoever. And I think the Polish people, though, especially of that period, carry with them a kind of a sense of suffering. And Central Europe, I think, as a whole, has this sort of agony to it that is very moving. There's an essay from the early 80s by a psychoanalyst whose name isn't coming to me right now, but it's on the agony of Central Europe. Whenever it comes to mind, I'll let you know what it is. But I've been very moved, frankly, by the writings and by the ideas, and really by the culture of that part of the world. I know we talk a lot about the Global South, and I think we should talk a lot about the Global South, but I think we don't talk enough about the Central European legacy, in particular for Roman Catholics of Poland, which is of that region, you know, the most Roman Catholic, you know, society there. Now, John Paul II was raised in this era, in this period. And his response to it is interesting, and it sort of points us towards what we do tomorrow. His interests during his period, his formative interests, were twofold. They were literary, artistic, on the one hand, and philosophical and intellectual on the other. Someone mentioned this, I think, yesterday, but when you talk about enemies of the state, there is no enemy of the state greater than the poet or the philosopher. Mm-hmm. Right. And in the case of John Paul II, his formative years in Krakow, I believe, his theater troupe was a subversive underground theater troupe. So John Paul II, through art, engaged in a sort of protest activism. Right. And so you might wonder, oh, his plays must be very political, right? Well, I'm not aware of all of his plays, but the play that I am deeply aware of and that I would encourage all of you to at least read, and I've had the pleasure of seeing it performed as well, is The Jeweler's Shop.
Yeah. Did he wrote it?
Yeah. The Jeweler's Shop is just an absolute... In fact, you might say, like, what's the inspiration that gives you... You know, because I have a mandatum, which means I have to obey my bishop, right? So I'm not allowed to really go off the rails here. So what gives you the audacity to say publicly and on record that you're just giving a secular, you know, rendition? You could say it's The Jeweler's Shop. Because the psychology of marriage that John Paul II offers in The Jeweler's Shop, which I misspelled... is so astounding that at first I was like, he must have been pulling this out of like confessions, right? Like he must have been like hearing confession and hearing all these couples talking about their lives, and he must have been like taking notes. And then I found out he wrote it long before he ever became a priest. He had no sociological insight available to him on the intimacies, and not the intimacies, but the most difficult intimacies of marriage, the alienation, the self-loathing, the sense of being abandoned and yet being together, like this very complicated sea of relations. That also includes love and passion and all of these things. And now you might say, so what does this have to do again with Sambivici the Lotus and da-da-da? Well, my point is that his mode of activism for his theater writing was not, on the one hand, overtly political. On the other hand, it was deeply subversively political, such that it had to be hidden away and done in secret, right? So there's this twofold irony to John Paul II's work as an artist. And a lot of people like to talk about John Paul II as a guy who, you know, he dabbled in art when he was a young man, like everyone does, right? You know, and then he grew up and became a proper cleric, and you know, and then we know him, you know, as the Pope. Well, this simply is not true. He wrote poetry till the end of his days. And there's a collection out for whom his dear friend, his dear friend and cardinal from Germany, Joseph Ratzinger, who I think by this time had actually become pope, wrote a commentary, a poetic commentary, on the poetry of his friend John Paul II. It's a striking work. I have to look up the title, but it shows evidence of the fact that this was not simply activism for the sake of activism, but it was actually fueled first and foremost by a passion as an artist, right? And for a passion.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Breadbox Media.
There, I'm Kim Tizer, your humble host of Our Catholic Way, where each week I invite guests to open up their heart and share their personal faith story. We all have a story, and my goal is to enrich yours. Interviews, thoughtful commentary, humor, and life shared. That's what you can expect from Our Catholic Way. I mentioned I was humble, right? Find showtimes at breadboxmedia.com.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Julia Kristeva, the great psychoanalyst and feminist, in some ways anti-feminist in some respects, wrote of John Paul II that he was the Pope with a body. And if you look at him when he's young, he's definitely the Pope with the body. And if you look at him when he's old, he's also the Pope with the body in an interesting way. But the embodiment of John Paul II is something that I think we can see as an outgrowth of his work as an artist in the theater. You have to have a body if you're going to be an actor. If you walk on stage, you need to bring a presence into the room. You can't walk on the stage in such a way where people might not realize that you're there, right? And so whenever we see the travels of John Paul II, unprecedented really for a pope.
With 80 feet.
Exactly, yeah. He arrives in Mexico and he gets down on all fours and kisses the ground. Being Mexican myself, yeah, that does it. I mean, his endearment in Mexico will never fade for that one act of deeply embodied, things. In fact, I worry sometimes that Francis gets a bit too much new credit for a kind of embodied engagement in public that we oftentimes forget that in his day, John Paul II was a sheer force of embodied presence in his travels and in his visits. However, the question of suffering then, going back to this opening move, also brings him into contact with the intellectual tradition that was probably dealing most closely with the present questions surrounding suffering, namely the tradition of phenomenology in Europe. So I talked a bit about this yesterday, but I want to reemphasize this. So phenomenology is an outgrowth a philosophical tradition that grows out of a particular discontent with modernity, modern thought, and really with the way things are in Germany, Austria, Central Europe at the turn of the century. It's seen the rise of science, it's seen the rise of revolutions, it's seen the rise of the nation state, it's seen the rise of post-agrarian society, it's seen all these things, and it feels deeply inside of itself that something has been lost in this translation and in this transition, and that the thing that has been lost is the thing that is most dear to us as human beings, which is our sense of the life world, our sense of the reality of things, our sense of the real even itself. And so this tradition, which begins with Edmund Husserl a student of the former Dominican monk, Franz Brentano. It starts off on embedded on two particular claims. One I said yesterday, one I'll add in today to make sense of why John Paul II, in my mind, really gets suffering in a way that really no one before him probably could, just because they didn't have the resources for it. The first claim of phenomenology is a positive thesis, namely that consciousness isn't just a blob, that our psychology isn't just hovering, but that our consciousness always appears in an intentional way, that we are all deeply intentional beings, which means that I can't just be aware of something. I'm always aware of something. So this isn't intentionality like, what do you plan on eating for lunch today? It's not just planning. It's the fact that the very structure of our mind is such that it can't be the case without being the case in an object-directed way. So I can't just sit in this kind of airy, new agey mindfulness. No, my mind is always directed. Even if my mind is directed at itself, it's still object directed, right? And so this thesis that works itself out of Brentano, which Brentano himself took out of the medieval scholastic tradition, being his Dominican training, is fundamental for Husserl, that shows him that there are some major mistakes being made in the philosophical world at that time that reduces consciousness to things that are foreign to its intentionality. And this is where the critical thesis of phenomenology comes, which is the critique of psychologism. Psychologism is the view in which one assigns psychological properties to non-psychological things. It's also the view where one assigns non-psychological properties to psychological things. So you could say that intentionality is one of the ultimate expressions that is not psychologistic, because it treats thought not as a thing, but as a thing that is always in the process of being directed. But if we think about, for instance, the rise of logic, mathematics, and scientific discovery in this kind of quantitative, numerative sense, you can see how Husserl, also trained in mathematics, realized that we have reduced the world itself to number. But the world is not a number. And so the reduction of reality to a set of logical properties, or the idea that we could reduce human behavior to a set of logical assignments that only really apply within a narrow, strict domain of Aristotelian or after Aristotle, Frege's logic or whatever's logic, this to him was psychologistic, right? It was a category mistake with deep and dark implications. On the other hand, the tendency to psychologize our very psychology, which is to say, to talk about our own thinking as if it's thinking, or to reduce thinking itself to something that has properties of thought. This is just a confused kind of mess of assumptions, and Husserl wanted to pierce through that mess through this idea of his critique of psychologism. If you want to read these books, Crisis of the European Sciences is a great place to start, and his Ideas 1 and 2, mainly Ideas 1, is also a really good book where you can find, especially the critique of psychologism, really well expressed there. John Paul II is influenced by this tradition, which is kind of homegrown. We tend to overemphasize the tradition's growth in Austria and Germany, but it was also growing at the same rate and pace in places like Poland,
Belgium, Czech Republic.
Yes, absolutely, Belgium. Yeah, I mean, it was really much bigger, I think, than it gets represented today. And so the students of Husserl, who sort of learned under his kind of newly formulated school of phenomenology, are quite a few of them. There's Max Scheler, Dietrich von Hildebrand, both of them, one of them very Catholic, the other one Catholic for a period. And then people like Martin Heidegger, a very famous German philosopher. People like Maurice Merleau-Ponty, very famous French philosopher. People like Edith Stein, who later becomes Sister Benedicta of the Cross. And then even people who were influenced by the students of Husserl, like Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, and the whole entire school, really, of modern, of 20th century existentialism, which is not quite the same as Nietzsche and Kierkegaard that we talked about yesterday. Yeah.
Sorry, how do you spell that, Husserl?
Oh, Husserl, yeah. No worries.
Wrong shape. Oh, what the hell? I thought you said R.
H-U-S-S-E-R-L. Edmund Husserl, yeah. Now, every student of Husserl comes up with a different rendition of what phenomenology as a school should be. And people, especially like Heidegger, in fact, have very harsh critiques of their teacher, Husserl, with respect to what phenomenology should be. John Paul II drank deeply from not only these more popular names, but also from other names. And in many cases, phenomenology was a tradition that also mixed very easily and very well with literary traditions. So a lot of poets, like John Paul II himself, but others, found this tradition interesting or useful. Now, you can see the danger of phenomenology, perhaps. So phenomenology can only study that which appears. It's a study of appearances. Appearances that appear in consciousness. Consciousness which is always intentional. Consciousness which is always intentional, in which the appearance appear in such a way in which the structure of the appearance can't be reduced to a psychologistic account, right? I mean, these are all the different moving parts when you put them together. Because of this, there is a certain kind of subjectivity to the appearance, because there's no such thing. It would be psychologistic to talk about the appearance in vague terms, right? The appearance only appears within consciousness to you and to you and to you and to you, right? There's no such thing as a universal objective appearance, unless, of course, we get to the very structure of the conditions for the possibility of appearance itself. So is it the case that things appear subjectively in an objective, you could say, way? This question, though, of subjectivity and objectivity is kind of an obsession in Catholicism that I kind of find a little bit odd, and I'm going to be as audacious as to use our next pope as a way to kind of disentangle that. He's very famous for supposedly having a real problem with relativism, but I have some text here I'm going to share with you that might show you a more dimension to that worry. The point I want to make here is that John Paul II, through both his artistic embodiment and also through his deep consideration of the appearance of phenomena to consciousness, which of course brings us to the experience of reality, the subjective experience of the self, of the other, of society, gives him a unique window within which to truly see in a full way the reality of suffering. A reality of suffering that is not wholly reducible to the metaphysical arguments about evil. A reality of suffering that is, for him, social, political, contemporary, contextual, but surely also that for him is also something interior, something inside, something he can see, and something that he can describe to us in terms coming out of the phenomenological tradition that are really unlike the terms of other parts of this tradition. And so we could say that in a small way, John Paul II, Karol Wojtyla's affection for phenomenology is another one of these Christianizing of a tradition that wasn't homegrown within the church, despite Brentano's influence on that and Aquinas' influence on Brentano. What that gives us, though, is a way to approach goodness that isn't saccharine, that isn't syrupy, that isn't obvious, that isn't boring. And John Paul II's motto for his pontificate, I think, speaks directly to the main thesis that arrives to us in what you could say is the extended commentary on suffering that he offers throughout his pontificate. the coraggio, be not afraid, right? Courage. John Paul II was speaking this way. Now, he spoke this way to lots of different audiences, and oftentimes we forget that one of the earliest audiences that heard the coraggio, be not afraid, was the Solidarity Unions in Poland, of which the idea of solidarity, of course, grows out of the Catholic social teaching of Rerum Novarum that I talked about last week, but also other views. Now, just because he advocated be not afraid to the unions of Poland doesn't mean that he was afraid at all of the communist Soviet bloc. And so I think if there's good reason to say that the account of the fall of the Soviet communist experiment had a great deal to do with one of its greatest opponents, who also happened to be the Pope at his time. For him, Soviet communism was not an abstraction at all. It was a very real thing that I think he understood in a particular way. And I think he showed the same sort of political courage that he showed in his earlier days in his underground theater troupe. But this idea of not fearing, not being afraid, I think gives us insight to not only the nature of suffering he gives us, but especially the portrait he paints whenever he's at the end of his life. So at the end of his life, we find a decrepit pope who can barely speak. And I got to see firsthand an example of sort of like a phenomenology of suffering that both had the technical, philosophical aspects and also the artistic and performative ones. So I want to just actually tell you a story, which is actually, I think, pretty funny, about the one time I got to see the Pope. And then I want to kind of narrate that story in closing as a way to make sense of this idea of suffering on these two horns of, on the one hand, the arts, and on the other hand, philosophy, to hopefully bring this through.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Redbox Media.
This is the Bible Study Evangelista, Sonia Corbett, inviting you to join me for some Bible study spinach that tastes like cake here on Breadbox Media. My scripture study series are created with you in mind to help you make a space in your busy heart and busy schedule for God to love and lift you all the way up into His lap. And there, all you've been given is loved and lifted too. So tune in to Bible Study Evangelista here on Breadbox Media, live or by podcast. It's Bible study in your pocket.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
This is Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
But this idea of not fearing and not being afraid, I think, gives us insight to not only the nature of suffering he gives us, but especially the portrait he paints whenever he's at the end of his life. So at the end of his life, we find a decrepit pope who can barely speak. And I got to see firsthand an example of sort of like a phenomenology of suffering that both had the technical, philosophical aspects and also the artistic and performative ones. So I want to just actually tell you a story, which is actually, I think, pretty funny, about the one time I got to see the Pope. And then I want to kind of narrate that story in closing as a way to make sense of this idea of suffering on these two horns of, on the one hand, the arts, and on the other hand, philosophy, to hopefully bring this through. I'm leaving out some things. I'm leaving out love and responsibility. I'm leaving out the Wednesday lectures. I'm leaving out all this stuff. I think these only add. I don't think they subtract from the account I'm trying to give here. So I was in Rome studying abroad for my Austrian study abroad program with Franciscan University of Steubenville in the spring of 2004. And I was at St. Peter's Square for the Sunday Ubi et Orbi address that usually that the Pope traditionally gives from the papal apartment that faces out, right? Mm-hmm. And so by this point in time, the Pope is very, very much in the point at which he can't hold his head up completely. where his entire body is basically hunched over and where basically sort of like leans almost on the microphone, right? And his voice has that low growling, you know, that kind of, you know, so where you have to listen almost so intensely to try and pull everything out. And it's Rome, so, you know, every address is given in, what, 9 to 12 languages, depending, you know. So they go, so it takes forever to give this very short address because they go through each language, you know, one by one by one. I'm there with a group of students, classmates of mine, and also some people from the Legionaries, Legionaries of Christ there in town. That's a whole different side of the story. Yeah, we're not going there, sorry. But behind us are a group of pilgrims from Mexico. And they are so excited to meet the Pope because, you know, this is the Pope that kissed the ground. And their excitement is like a soccer match excitement, right? So they are chanting soccer chants, basically, from the moment, like, they show up, even before the Pope comes out. And then whenever the Pope comes out, they just start screaming and yelling, and he's giving this address, and, like, it's hard to hear already because the acoustics in St. Peter's Basilica are bad, and the Pope doesn't have the ability to enunciate, and everyone's like leaning in on every word. And behind us, there's a group of Mexicans that are just losing their minds, you know, singing, you know, barabi, barabo. You know, they're just going on and on. They have signs, and so people behind them can't see. And people are getting really annoyed, and especially my friends are kind of looking at me like, can you talk to your people? Please tell them to, you know, put their signs down and be reverent and, you know, and respect, you know, show some respect for John Paul II. And I'm just trying to, like, avoid eye contact. Right? But at a certain point, I'm, like, looking at the sky, you know. And so the Pope goes into his comments, and very selfishly, when he goes into his Spanish comments, they kind of quiet down. And he's in the and by the way, he's completely on the script, right? He's got this has been written out. He's speaking, you know, very methodically. So everyone's getting the same ingredients. No one's getting any, you know.
Does he get the address in 9 different languages himself?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure John Paul II was fluent in 7 and could probably read at least 12. Oh, you know? All the popes are pretty much that way.
Yeah.
I find it funny. Well, I find a lot of things about the presidential politics south of the border funny, but one of the things I find so funny is that
they can't speak Spanish.
Usually, they can barely speak English. Sort of like, you know, something sort of civically unimpressive about the linguistic abilities. Yeah. That as a Roman Catholic, I feel very sort of here. I'll be a bit triumphant, right? I just, well, yeah, of course, we do that, right? So he's speaking in Spanish, and they quiet down a bit to listen to him, and just. And in a point that was almost like as if he was pointing out the fact that this is not planned, obviously, he just leans to the mic and goes, Viva Mexico. And the Mexicans go crazy. And so do us. And everyone goes crazy. And everyone's like, Mexico! Yeah. You know, but in that moment, the relationship to the Mexican pilgrims changed all around them and in the entire plaza. And there was a sense in which the Pope took the people who were the most annoying and the most disrespectful and the most, but who probably loved him the most too, right? And he changed the very kind of fabric of that relationship. And at the same time, this was a period of time where he was deeply being criticized for sticking around, right? Mm-hmm. He also showed very abundantly that intentionality is not just a theory. I'm not just a blob of flesh out here reading through pages. I am an object-directed subject. I can improvise if I want to. And I can improvise in a pastoral way and all this thing. So I think that story shows at some level the fact that there was almost a performative element to the fact that he stayed in so long, because he showed us the body in the face of suffering. He showed us a phenomenology of what it is to suffer, which was not just putting suffering on display in some kind of a voyeuristic sort of a way, but the message in terms of revealing suffering is to say, be not afraid. Look at me. I can barely talk. So if you want to know what goodness is as a transcendental, my claim on the consideration of the other side of goodness, principally through evil, through the particular expression of evil, which we find in suffering, that John Paul II not only gives us a phenomenology of suffering, but also a pastoral theology of suffering, in which he shows the redemptive possibility of suffering, which of course unites itself to the cross and all those things. But he chooses to not externalize it for us, but to live it out, to show it, to put it on display, to perform it, and to perform it with a set of philosophical principles coming out of phenomenology, where we see that the performance is an intentional performance, where we see that this isn't just I'm laying on the bed and, you know, but that there's dignity here, right? And so for me, if we want to understand an idea of the transcendental of goodness that goes beyond the easy, understandable idea that, like, do you want to eat good food or bad food? Or that whole calculus of good versus bad. And, well, don't we want good things, not bad things? There's something about that calculus that is calculating that leads to something like a psychologistic reduction, where we reduce goodness to this very careful calculus of distinctions between the good and the bad, or a spectrum of goodness between really good to like really bad or whatever. But I think what we see in John Paul II is that goodness is not a quantifiable object that we can understand by logic chopping, but that goodness is a reality that can be embodied, that can be lived, and that can even be found in the darkest places of the human experience, namely the places where we find ourselves suffering, where we find pain, where we even find evil.
We'll be back with more Catholic intellectual tradition on Redbox Media.
This is Chuck Coughlin, and I really want to talk with you. Why don't you meet with me at 11 p.m. Monday through Friday on RedboxMedia.com? My show is called Setting the Record Straight. We celebrate the glorious and unmatched history of our beloved Catholic Church. We talk about the good that the Catholic Church has done for the whole world. It needs to be better known. It is so little known. Please come join me. I'll be waiting for you there, 11 p.m. Monday through Friday, and together we can set the record straight.
Sam Rocha, and you are listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition, given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
If we want to understand an idea of the transcendental of goodness that goes beyond the easy, understandable idea that, like, do you want to eat good food or bad food? Or that whole calculus of good versus bad? And, well, don't we want good things, not bad things? There's something about that calculus that is calculating that leads to something like a psychologistic reduction, where we reduce goodness to this very careful calculus of distinctions between the good and the bad, or a spectrum of goodness between really good to like really bad or whatever. But I think what we see in John Paul II is that goodness is not a quantifiable object that we can understand by logic chopping, but that goodness is a reality that can be embodied, that can be lived, and that can even be found in the darkest places of the human experience, namely the places where we find ourselves suffering, where we find pain, where we even find evil. Now,
so is it? I'm just trying to think. He also has a very deep devotion to to Mary.
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. Totally.
And
yeah.
So he identifies naturally with her suffering
totally.
Over the cross.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And because here she is. Yeah, I mean, what a model of the dignity of suffering.
Completely. And I'll remind you, many of you have heard me talk, have heard me make this point, but I'll make this in terms of Mary. So after the resurrection, Jesus doesn't show up with all his wounds cleaned up. He appears with open wounds. The testimony of the resurrection is not a testimony that is completely glorified flesh that hasn't been harmed and has been healed and sewn up and completely cleaned off. Francis testifies to suffering through wearing the wounds of Christ, which remain after resurrection. And when we look at Mary, I think we see a similar thing. Mary's memory in the tradition of the early church was not of a woman pacing around and be like, my son was God, he saved the world.
Yeah.
No, it was of a memorializing of the suffering of her son, of a desire to not forget. And so I think with John Paul II, we see a similar spirituality that has the capacity to not only literally suffer, not only remind us of the salvific possibility of suffering, but to show us that goodness doesn't always appear in what seems most immediately good, but that we can find goodness even in those things in which we can't imagine there being anything good, whether it's disrespectful Mexicans or whether it's someone whose body is literally crumbling in front of the world's eyes, whether it's political repression and despotism, whatever it's the case, whether it's the Roman Empire in this case or Nazism, right? But I think what he shows us is the fact that, as a similar insight that we see more metaphysically in Augustine, is that we never need to worry so much about the antithesis of goodness, because goodness is always, you could say, already present in not only the metaphysical structure of reality, but even in the phenomenological experience of reality that we have. Yeah.
So I say, it's almost like when you hear that, you know, God can make something good out of the most evil, you know, things mm-hmm. and the most tragic things.
Sure.
So there's always goodness that comes out. Would that be something kind of...
It would be, but it would be saying that God doesn't make things good out of evil, but everything that is evil has already some sort of signage of goodness there, right? And of course, there are paradoxes that arise here. Go back to my friend who tells me that, like, this is an exit point for I have a person in mind for her, right? And her experience of the world. The phenomenological testimony of John Paul II doesn't, as a new logic, enter the scene and be like, oh, well, you just haven't heard of my Pope, you know. No. What it demands is a new phenomenological response and experience and discussion. And you have to take on the part of, you know, sharing and listening and what have you. And so one of the most impactful essays that I'm sure was impactful in John Paul II by Max Scheler is an essay called On the Nature of Sympathy. It's a beautiful, beautiful... Scheler is the guy who wrote Ressentiment, right? As a theoretical project of trying to describe and counter points, but also take seriously Nietzsche's accusation of genealogy of morals, yeah, I would read Scheler's Ressentiment. It's a very moving and beautiful piece. But his essay on the nature of sympathy is... it's almost pastoral, you could say. It really gets down to the depths of the ways in which sympathy is neither disinterested nor interested. Like the very kind of depths of the ways in which sympathy, fellow feeling for the other, is complicated, and that can only be understood phenomenologically, so to speak. You know. Now, during John Paul II's pontificate, he didn't just do all phenomenology and poetry all the time. I think he was convicted when he showed up in Rome that, like, oh, the prevailing school of thought here is clearly Thomism. It's clearly Thomas Aquinas. Mm-hmm. And so we see, though, in John Paul II, what we see in the wider field of the engagement in Europe between classical Thomism and things like personalism and phenomenology and things that want to take the subjective side of experience more seriously. We see this whenever he's struggling, for instance, in the Wednesday lectures, to try and show, well, there's an objective basis here, but it can only be understood subjectively in this way, and the body, which we may take to be this or that. I mean, he's trying to puzzle out how you can get a Thomist orthodoxy that is sensitive to and even respondent to the newer insights of phenomenology. And I think that his Wednesday lectures should be seen as a more speculative set of teachings on that particular problem than as a sort of definitive statement on the body. You know, I mean, I don't know if that's the best way to read them. But if you want to read a book where someone is struggling to make sense of taking the subjective side of human experience seriously while being a very orthodox Thomist, the best book on that is by Norris Clark, and it's called Person and Being. Person and Being. And it's a lovely short little lecture that he gave at Marquette University, where he represents very much the Thomistic school, but shows an enormous generosity towards the emergent tradition of Christian personalism, Christian humanism, which would include phenomenology and even things like Christian existentialism, right? When we look at the 20th century and you see like Jean-Paul Sartre's Being and Nothingness and obviously kind of this very kind of flamboyant atheism and voyeurism and stuff like that, you would be like, oh, Catholics have nothing to do with that. That's not true at all.
Well, I mean, Sartre's coming from a very Catholic, what was once a very Catholic place.
Yeah, no, totally. And if you want to read a description of why Sartre stopped being Catholic, read his intellectual autobiography, Les Mots, The Words. The Words is what it's called. And it gives a very powerful account of his sort of conversion to atheism, which was built on him realizing that his grandparents didn't really believe any of this stuff, that was, you know, that this was a sort of a formal civic kind of a thing. When I read that, I was like, yeah, you probably have good reason for it. But alongside the sort of more atheistic and secular accounts of existentialism, you have people like Mounier and certainly people like the more Jewish thinker. By the way, there's a huge Judaism thing that's cross-fertilizing all this kind of stuff that's going on. But I and Thou, Martin Buber, his work is deeply influential. Also on John Paul II as well. Anyhow, but this is all going on. The point is to say that when we think about the transcendental thing of beauty, and I want to talk about transcendence as a thing that can pierce, for a lot of people, suffering is an unpierceable object. The good, a conceptual good, can't quite get through that. My claim is that John Paul II, through the arts, but also through phenomenology, gives an account of goodness that doesn't have to end immediately when it encounters suffering. And he, of course, takes this on personally through his own suffering, through, you know, this is the later years of his life. And so perhaps when we think of goodness, instead of thinking of it as that thing that is the opposite of bad, and that, you know, you're trying to figure out the more maybe philosophical objections and problems that we looked at before, but that when we think of goodness in this phenomenological way, that what we really realize is that the good is not just something to be disputed or thought about, but it's something that we can actually pursue and pursue with a transcendent sort of confidence. And that's what inspires courage and, you know, lack of fear. So that's my argument for goodness, right? Goodness that isn't impervious to suffering, goodness that isn't externalized as a floating idea, goodness that we can find especially in the artistic and phenomenological account of suffering that we see in the work combined of John Paul II. That's my case.
Excellent.
Any questions?
Well, wouldn't it be extremely good if we remove the reason of causing the bad?
If you remove the...
Well, remove the Well, it would be extremely good if we remove the factor that causing the good, lesser good. I mean, the lesser good.
Something oh, sure. That well, this brings us to the question of freedom, which is the missing ingredient, I think, of what I just rehearsed with John Paul II. I think he has a view of freedom in particular that actually probably goes back to someone I haven't talked about enough, but I'll try to bring up in the next point, which is Newman and the role of conscience and the question of freedom, because that also is Augustine's approach, right?
This is Sam Rocha, and you have been listening to a Breadbox Media presentation of my lectures on the Catholic intellectual tradition given at St. Mark's College in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Hey, Dave, do you hear about the new podcast?
No, what is it?
It's The Catholic Man Show with Adam Minahan and David Niles.
Is that us?
That is us.
We have a podcast?
We have a podcast on breadboxmedia.com.
That's awesome. What's our show about?
It's about manly stuff, like our Catholic faith.
I love our Catholic faith. Jesus is so manly.
So you need to definitely subscribe.
Okay, I will. How do I do that?
Just visit breadboxmedia.com and type in The Catholic Man Show.
Man, you got it. Hey, is that website gluten-free?